It is Monday, August 16th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up, it's a big day in the U.S. election campaign with Hillary Clinton campaigning in Pennsylvania with Vice President Joe Biden and Donald Trump giving a policy speech on terrorism. We'll speak to our correspondent who traveled recently to the Pennsylvania town where the Clinton family has deep ties. A U.S. political scientist will also tell us why Trump is appealing to many white working-class voters across the U.S. We'll get an update on the conflict in Afghanistan, and we'll look back at how the U.S. Olympic team dominated the swimming events in Rio. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, several thousand Clinton supporters have gathered in Scranton, Pennsylvania, to see a joint appearance by Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and Vice President Joe Biden. Clinton's father was born in Scranton, and she spent her summers there as a child. VOA correspondent Aru Pandey recently traveled to this traditional Democratic Party stronghold, where Clinton hopes to tap into her roots to win votes in November.
Scranton restaurateur Paul Cooper remembers the day in 1993 he met Hillary Clinton and her husband, then newly elected President Bill Clinton.
She couldn't be any nicer to me. As far as I'm concerned, they were really nice people. I mean, they seemed really down to earth, really nice people.
The Clintons hosted a gathering at Cooper's Seafood House restaurant 23 years ago, following the funeral of Hillary's father, Hugh Rodham, who was born in Scranton. The city has long been a solid stronghold for the Democratic Party, but its white working-class demographics align nearly perfectly with Donald Trump's base. While the Republican candidate has been trying to make inroads there, political scientist Christopher Borick says it may be difficult.
I think it's still a very strong place for Democratic candidates, especially when you add on the local dimension with Hillary Clinton and her family there. So it's got some powerful roots historically that are going to make it hard necessarily for Donald Trump to come in and just sweep away an area.
Hillary Clinton's ties to the area run deep. Her grandfather worked at the Scranton Lace Company behind me. The textile plant closed in 2002 after more than 100 years in operation.
Other plants in the region have closed too over the years, leaving many workers jobless. Lifelong resident Marty Corr remembers a time when industry was bustling in the Scranton area.
I could take you to about 10 factories in the immediate 10 miles of here that are gone. I used to pick up a lot of garment industry. I was a truck driver.
His son, Marty Corr Jr., now runs the family restaurant in nearby Dunmore. Two Brothers Pizza recently made national headlines after Corr made what he called a Madam President pizza, topped with hot sauce in honor of Clinton's visit to the area in April. His daughter was invited to meet the Democratic presidential candidate.
And how many 12-year-old girls from Dunmore, whose father made a pizza, got to meet someone of that stature? I mean, she's a brilliant woman. She's smart. So if you are a young girl, look up to her. I mean, that shows you can do something with your life.
Marty doesn't want to talk politics, but he has a message for politicians.
Worry about the working people, the people that strive and put their business, that have been here. You know, that's the most important. We're the people that make America great. Not Trump, not Hillary, it's the people.
A message he and others hope the candidates hear as the U.S. presidential campaign gets more heated. Aru Pandey, VOA News, Scranton.
Well, our correspondent Aru Pandey is actually with me in the studio now. Hi, Aru.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good, thanks. So, Aru, what was it like to be in Scranton with all those people, including those in the pizzeria?
Well, it's traditional working class. These are the voices that you hear. I was just driving around. I went to this one pizza restaurant and talked to Marty Corr, who made this, you know, H pizza, and he talked about why he did it. He's like, look, you know, I own a business. I know that this is something that people would attract customers, but at the same time, he didn't want to get political, which I thought was interesting. I expected to go there and find a lot of people who are, yes, I'm Clinton, I'm a Democrat.
Because her family has
exactly,
the roots here.
Exactly, because, you know, she's been there so many times just in her political career, and then obviously her childhood she spent, you know, on a lake outside of Scranton. Like I mentioned in my story, her grandfather worked in a lace factory that closed down actually in 2002. Her father was born there. Her father is buried there. And so I just expected to see a lot more of that, at least visually. But what I heard was a lot of people are on the fence or don't want to say who exactly they're voting for, which is an interesting part of this election cycle where you see people are saying, you know, especially people who own businesses, I don't want to say. I don't want to tell you who I'm voting for.
Why do you think that is?
They've gotten hate. Marty Kaur said that, you know, when his he was invited for his daughter to, you know, meet Hillary Clinton, went to the rally, he said he got people, whether through social media, saying, you know what, Trump supporters who are unhappy. So I think that's also a snapshot of this election. But this is a industrial city. There are tons of factories, RCA, so many factories that were there. What I heard from people is that a lot of them have closed down, and there is that disaffection there.
Could that be briefly an opening for Trump, perhaps?
Well, he's played to it. During the Democratic National Convention, he went to Scranton and actually held a rally there, which was seemed like a perfect counterpoint. And then he promised, I'm going to bring the coal industry back, which some analysts say is kind of ridiculous because the coal industry went away in the 1950s. So people here aren't expecting the coal industry to come back, but they do want to see more jobs, more industry. They blamed trade agreements like NAFTA and said that more needs to be done to foster these formerly industrial cities.
Okay, well, thank you very much to our correspondent, Arup Pandey, for telling us more about Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Thank you.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is due to give a speech on how he would fight the Islamic State militant group later Monday at Youngstown State University in Ohio. Stay tuned to VOA for coverage of that address. Now, when Trump first announced he was running for president, many people, including those in the media, didn't take him seriously. But in primary after primary, he won easily against a big field of competitors led by white working-class voters without a college degree. Well, Justin Guest is a professor at George Mason University's School of Public Policy. International Edition's Lori London asked him why many of Trump's white working-class supporters don't seem to be bothered by the controversial things that he says.
The reason why, Lori, is because these are folks who are not used to being represented publicly, affectionately, and affirmatively by mainstream politicians over the last 40 years. There was an era in American politics where the white working class was the heart and soul of the electorate, where politicians outwardly sought out their votes. And over the last 40 years, as their numbers have diminished, as their power in unions have diminished, fewer and fewer politicians actually do that. So when someone like Donald Trump, with all of his status and all of his celebrity, says, I care specifically about you, it's going to win you a lot of fans amongst a group of people who has otherwise felt really marginalized.
His opponents would argue that while these people may feel like he is in their corner, it's just not so. What do the facts say?
There have been many allegations that white working class people vote irrationally, that they don't vote with their interests. And I can tell you that that is wholly untrue. White working class know precisely why they're voting for Donald Trump. It's just not rational from the perspective of people who are not white working class. Rationality is really very much a subjective phenomenon, right? There are certain forms of rationality depending on the lens that you take. And many of the folks who accuse right working class people of being irrational are usually looking through an economic lens. Now, that was, I think, especially true given white working class support of Republicans in earlier election cycles. But in this election cycle, Donald Trump speaks economically to many white working class people in light of his protectionist economic policies, at least from a trade perspective. And so they see that as a clear way of supporting their economic prospects. From a social perspective, many white working class people feel that they are ultimately disadvantaged in the very countries that they once defined. And Donald Trump speaks to that as well. And so whether or not it's right, whether it's racist, you know, that's going to be debated. And many people, I think, quite rightfully think it is. However, ultimately, from a white working class person's perspective, the rational choice is Donald Trump. And it's just very hard for many cosmopolitans, many liberals, many authors and people in the media to accept.
So even when he's blustery or when he makes boastful comments about himself, they actually, what I'm hearing is they actually like that about him.
In some cases, they're going to like it. And, you know, it's hard to generalize across all of his supporters. Many of them may like that confidence, that brashness, that nationalism that comes from it. And they want to feel like America is strong, and they feel strong through his expressions of strength, whether it's bravado and fluffery. However, for others, they may not like it, and they may feel discomforted by it, but they are sufficiently persuaded by his policy proposal and general rhetoric that they will vote for him despite that.
And that was Lori London speaking with Justin Guest, author of the book The New Minority: White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. Well, it's time now for our social media segment, and G. Abby Lee is back with me in the studio with the trending story online. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael. Let's talk about Paul Manafort. He's a campaign chairman for GOP nominee Donald Trump, and he's on Twitter at Paul Manafort, M-A-N-A-F-O-R-T. And he uses the hashtags Make America Great Again and TrumpPen16 in his Twitter profile.
So what's the latest news about Manafort?
Well, it has to do with news coming out of Ukraine. The New York Times reported Ukraine's National Anti-Corruption Bureau announced its letters show former President Viktor Yanukovych's administration paid nearly $13 million to Manafort. And many media outlets picked up the story that argued Manafort worked for the deposed president for years. Many also noted Donald Trump has been unusually positive about Russian President Vladimir Putin throughout the campaign.
Well, this news has been trending since Sunday night, right?
Mm-hmm,
and what's the reaction like?
Well, most of the tweets using hashtag Manafort are critical of his claims that the New York Times is biased against the Trump campaign. One user tweeted, blasting New York Times as biased, Manafort forgets that the same paper broke the Clinton email story earlier this year. And another person wrote, that moment when you can't tell if you're reading the morning news or the Americans FX plot summary. And The Americans is a drama about the marriage of two KGB spies posing as Americans in the 1980s.
I haven't seen that show yet.
Well, do you want to now that you know the story about Manafort?
Perhaps, yeah.
Another trending hashtag related to this story is hashtag Manafort cash. So that's not positive as well. But it was quite challenging to find tweets that are supportive of Manafort in this regard. But one user, whose handle is at P0TUS Trump, wrote this. The press makes up stories about Trump, makes up stories about Manafort, yet can't actually cover real events about Hillary. Hashtag propaganda. That's all for me today, Michael. Back to you.
Thanks so much, G. If you want to follow G on Twitter, her handle is at G Abby Lee. I'm on Twitter at Michael_Lippin, and the show is there too at VOA_IE. Well, here are some of the top stories now on voanews.com. Japanese PM again skips visit to controversial war shrine. UN condemns deadly airstrike on Yemen's school. U.S. Midwestern city of Milwaukee sees a second night of unrest after police shooting. South Korean leader vows strength on issues of national security. And U.S. Olympic medal-winning swimmer Lochte says he and other U.S. swimmers are safe and unharmed after robbery in Rio. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com. This is International Edition. Afghan officials say the Islamic State militant group has established a recruitment and training camp for Arabs and Chechens in the southern province of Zabul. Meanwhile, the Reuters news agency is reporting that Afghan security forces beat back recent attacks by the Taliban militant group close to the Lashkar Gah area, the capital of the contested province of Helmand. RAND Corporation South Asia analyst Jonah Blank told my colleague Victor Beatty that the report of an Islamic State presence in Zabul, if true, is quite worrisome.
ISIL, sometimes called the Islamic State or Daesh, has been predominantly active in the provinces of Nangarhar and Kunar, which are quite a ways away from Zabul. So we're getting this information from Afghan officials in the Afghan government. The U.S. military is less convinced that this is actually true, and I think we still need some more information to see how it plays out.
At the same time, just last Friday, the U.S. Defense Department confirmed that back in July, a drone strike killed the leader of IS in Afghanistan and Pakistan. How significant a development is that?
Well, it's always significant when a leader of ISIL gets killed. In this case, Hafez Saeed Khan was the leader of IS Khorasan, as it is called, and he had been a member of the Quetta-Shora Taliban and possibly also of the TTP, it's a little bit fuzzy, before he broke away to join ISIL.
I wanted to ask you briefly about Helmand Province. There have been media reports suggesting the Taliban is about to take over that province, perhaps even take over the provincial capital of Lashkar-Gah.
The Taliban has been heavily invested in Helmand. They've held parts of Helmand, for example, Musa Qala, during periods when they had almost no presence elsewhere in Afghanistan. Much of Helmand right now is effectively within Taliban control. They are well-armed, they're well-equipped. Helmand is one of the provinces that is really their base, their heartland, so it's not surprising that they are continuing to make strong inroads.
Well, the Pentagon is denying that the Helmand province is about to be overrun.
Making strong inroads and about to be overrun are different things. The Taliban has shown that they can take over territory. For example, the most audacious move they've made ever since 2001 has been when they invaded and took over the northern city of Kunduz, and they held it for 2 weeks. However, they only held it for 2 weeks. Likewise, in Helmand, the Taliban could take over perhaps Lashkar-Gah. Certainly a lot of Helmand could easily be overrun tomorrow. But the key question is, could they hold it?
And that was RAND Corporation's Jonah Blank speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA scientists at its Goddard Institute for Space Studies found that some 2 billion years ago, Venus had temperatures that could have made it habitable and a shallow liquid water ocean. The findings were made with a computer model like one being used to predict future climate change here on Earth. Conditions on Venus today are anything but habitable. Described by many as having a hellish environment, our neighboring planet has an incredibly dense atmosphere of carbon dioxide that is 90 times thicker than our own. Surface temperatures there can reach 462 degrees Celsius. Some scientists speculate its closeness to the sun caused its oceans to evaporate. Since it was then left with no surface water, carbon dioxide filled the atmosphere, which led to what some call a runaway greenhouse effect that created present conditions. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Well, it's day 10 of the Summer Olympics in Rio with 17 gold medals at stake. Monday's competition includes men's gymnastics medals being awarded for rings and vault. On the track, athletes will run for gold in the women's 400 meters. And to have a big result to report in the women's 3,000-meter steeplechase. Teenager Ruth Jebet won Bahrain's first-ever Olympic gold medal on Monday in that event, blowing away the competition but narrowly missing out on the world record. On day 9, one of the highlights was Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt still declaring himself to be the fastest man in the world. He won the men's 100 meters for a third consecutive Olympics, something no runner has ever done before. Well, looking back at swimming, for a swimmer who said he was done with the sport after the 2012 Olympics, American Michael Phelps put on a performance at the Rio Games that left most people at a loss for words. VOA's Park Brewer wraps up the 8 days of swimming in Rio.
In the final event Saturday, on the last night of swimming at the 2016 Summer Games, the 31-year-old Phelps capped off his incomparable Olympic career with a gold medal in the men's 4x100-meter medley relay. It gave him 5 golds and 1 silver medal in Rio and 23 career golds in his total of 28 Olympic medals. So could he change his mind about competing at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics?
This is it. I'm done. I couldn't be happier with how I finished my career, and there's no better way than finishing with a gold medal, that's for sure.
There's a good chance Phelps could now go into coaching. So with no Phelps, who might take over as the new face of American swimming? Most are betting on 19-year-old Katie Ledecky. At age 15, she surprisingly won the women's 800-meter freestyle at the 2012 London Olympics. Since then, her career has skyrocketed. The freestyle specialist won 4 gold medals and broke 2 world records at the 2013 World Championships, then did even better at the Worlds last year, winning 5 gold medals and breaking 3 world records. In Rio, Ledecky won 3 individual freestyle races and took gold and silver in the freestyle relays.
I've met all my goals, and I think, more importantly, I've had more fun than I could have ever imagined.
Ledecky is still an amateur and heads off soon for Stanford University in California to study and swim on her college team. Overall, the United States led all nations in the swim events in Rio with 16 golds and 33 total medals. Australia and Hungary were a distant second with 3 gold medals each. The Australians won 10 total medals. Hungary and Japan each had 7. 16 nations in all won Rio swimming medals, but host nation Brazil was shut out. History was made in the 100-meter butterfly, where Phelps won silver. 21-year-old Joseph Schooling touched the wall first, becoming the first-ever Olympic champion from Singapore. And the U.S. Olympic team also achieved a milestone on the final night of swimming. When the women's 4x100-meter relay team won the gold medal, it was the 1,000th gold medal all-time for Team USA at the Summer Games, dating back to the first modern Olympics in 1896. Park Brewer, VOA News, at the Rio Olympics.
Well, for more on the games, you can go to our website, voanews.com, which has a special section on the Rio Olympics. And that's where you can find the medal standings, with the USA still on top at 26 golds. Well, that's it for International Edition on the Voice of America. I'd like to thank my director, Patrice Martin, and the engineer, Keith Holmes. If you want to find me on Twitter, you can find me at Michael_Lippin. Thanks for joining us, and see you soon.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After a recent meeting at the Department of Defense with his National Security Council, President Barack Obama said that ISIL leaders know they will lose in Syria and Iraq. With support from the Counter-ISIL Coalition, local forces have made significant progress against ISIL in Iraq and Syria. They have taken key territory from ISIL and continue to advance in their planning and on the battlefield toward Mosul. In Syria, said the president, they are choking off the last entry to the ISIL stronghold of Raqqa. The military portion of the counter-ISIL strategy is showing great progress, President Obama said. The coalition air campaign continues to hit ISIL targets wherever the terrorists try to hide. American pilots are doing their best to avoid civilian casualties, in stark contrast to ISIL, which uses non-combatants as shields. Coalition and local forces continue to take out senior ISIL leaders and commanders, and this is having an effect on the organization's command and control and its discipline. None of ISIL's leaders are safe, and we are going to keep on going after them, said President Obama. The terror group continues to lose ground in Iraq and Syria. Iraqi forces have taken Fallujah and are pushing up the Euphrates River Valley. They are also pushing up the Tigris River, taking Qayyarah, and are preparing to launch an offensive against Mosul, the largest city still under ISIL control. Meanwhile, in Syria, Obama said, a coalition of local forces backed by our special operations forces and airstrikes continues to take the fight to ISIL as well. The coalition is fighting its way into the town of Manbij a gateway for ISIL fighters coming in and terrorists heading out to attack Europe, which is why ISIL was fighting hard to hold it. ISIL has not had a major successful offensive operation in either Syria or Iraq in a full year, said President Obama. Even ISIL's leaders know they're going to keep losing. In their message to followers, they're increasingly acknowledging that they may lose Mosul and Raqqa, and ISIL is right, he continued. They will lose them, and we'll keep hitting them and pushing them back and driving them out until they do.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.